in the 3rd and 2nd century BC, this release, this untethering of wealth, began to tell upon the general economic life of the Roman and Hellenized world. People began to buy land and the like, not for use, but to sell again at a profit. People borrowed to buy. Speculation developed. No doubt there were bankers in the Babylon of 1000 BC, but they lent in a far more limited and solid way, bars of metal and stocks of goods. That earlier world was a world of barter and payment in kind, and it went slowly, and much more staidly and stably for that reason. In that state, the vast realm of China has remained almost down to the present time. The big cities before Rome were trading and manufacturing cities. Such were Corinth and Carthage and Syracuse. But Rome never produced a very considerable industrial population, and her warehouses never rivaled those of Alexandria. The little port of Ostia was always big enough for her needs. Rome was a political and financial capital, and in the latter respect, at least, she was a new sort of city. She imported profits and tribute, and very little went out from her in return. The wharves of Ostia were chiefly busy unloading corn from Sicily and Africa, and loot from all the world. After the fall of Carthage, the Roman imagination went wild with the hitherto unknown possibilities of finance. Money, like most other inventions, had happened to mankind, and men had still to develop, today they have still to perfect, the science and morality of money. One sees the thing catching on in the recorded life and the writings of Cato the Censor. In his early days he was bitterly virtuous against usury. In his later, he was devising ingenious schemes for safe usury. In this curiously interesting century of Roman history, we find man after man asking, what has happened to Rome? Various answers are made. A decline in religion, a decline from the virtues of the Roman forefathers, Greek intellectual poison, and the like. We, who can look at the problem with a large perspective, can see that what had happened to Rome was money, the new freedoms and chances and opportunities that money opened out. Money floated the Romans off the firm ground. Everyone was getting hold of money, the majority by the simple expedient of running into debt. The eastward expansion of the empire was very largely a hunt for treasure in strong rooms and temples to keep pace with the hunger of the new need. The equestrian order, in particular, became the money power. Everyone was developing property. Farmers were giving up corn and cattle, borrowing money, buying slaves, and starting the more intensive cultivation of oil and wine. Money was young in human experience and wild. Nobody had it under control. It fluctuated greatly. It was now abundant and now scarce. Men made sly and crude schemes to corner it, to hoard it, to send up prices by releasing hoarded metals. A small body of very shrewd men was growing immensely rich. Many patricians were growing poor and irritated and unscrupulous. Among the middle sort of peoples, there was much hope, much adventure, and much more disappointment. The growing mass of the expropriated was permeated by that vague, baffled, and hopeless sense of being inexplicably bested, which is the preparatory condition for all great revolutionary movements. 3rd. The first conspicuous leader to appeal to the gathering revolutionary feeling in Italy was Tiberius Gracchus. He looks more like an honest man than any other figure in this period of history, unless it be Scipio Africanus the Elder. At first, Tiberius Gracchus was a moderate reformer of a rather reactionary type. He wished to restore the yeoman class to property, very largely because he believed that class to be the backbone of the army, and his military experience in Spain, before and after the destruction of Carthage, had impressed upon him the declining efficiency of the legions. He was what we should call nowadays a back-to-the-land man. He didn't understand, and few people understand today, how much easier it is to shift populations from the land into the towns than to return it to to the laborious and simple routines of agricultural life. He wanted to revive the Licinian laws which had been established when Camillus built his Temple of Concord nearly 2.5 centuries before, so far as they broke up great estates and restrained slave labour. These Licinian laws had repeatedly been revived and repeatedly lapsed to a dead letter again. It was only when the big proprietors in the Senate opposed this proposal that Tiberius Gracchus turned to the people and began a furious agitation for popular government. He created a commission to inquire into the title of all landowners. In the midst of his activities occurred one of the most extraordinary incidents in history. Attalus, the king of the rich country of Pergamum in Asia Minor, died in 133 BC and left his kingdom to the Roman people. It's difficult for us to understand the motives of this bequest. Pergamum was a country allied to Rome and so moderately secure from aggression, and the natural consequence of such a will was to provoke a violent scramble among the senatorial gangs and a dispute between them and the people for the spoils of the new acquisition. Practically, Attalus handed over his country to be looted. There were, of course, many Italian business people established in the country, and a strong party of native rich men in close relations with Rome. To them, no doubt, a coalescence with the Roman system would have been acceptable. Josephus bears witness to such a desire for annexation among the rich men of Syria, a desire running counter to the wishes of both king and people. This Pergamum bequest, astonishing in itself, had the still more astonishing result of producing imitations in other quarters. In 96 BC, Ptolemy Apion bequeathed Cyrenaica in North Africa to the Roman people. In 81 BC, Alexander II, king of Egypt, followed suit with Egypt, a legacy too big for the courage if not for the appetite of the senators, and they declined it. In 74 BC, Nicomedes, king of Bithynia, demised Bithynia. Of these latter testamentary freaks we'll say no more here, but it will be manifest how great an opportunity was given Tiberius Gracchus by the bequest of Attalus of accusing the rich of greed and of proposing to decree the treasures of Attalus to the commonalty. He proposed to use this new wealth to provide seed, stock, and agricultural implements for the resettlement of the land. His movement was speedily entangled in the complexities of the Roman electoral system. Without a simple and straightforward electoral method, all popular movements in all ages necessarily become entangled and maddened in constitutional intricacies, and almost as necessarily lead to bloodshed. It was needed, if his work was to go on, that Tiberius Gracchus should continue to be tribune, and it was illegal for him to be tribune twice in succession. He overstepped the bounds of legality and stood for the tribuneship a second time. The peasants, who came in from the countryside to vote for him, came in armed. The cry that he was aiming at a tyranny, the cry that had long ago destroyed Maelius and Manlius, was raised in the Senate. The friends of law and order went to the capital in state, accompanied by a rabble of dependents, armed with staves and bludgeons. There was a conflict, or rather a massacre, of the revolutionaries, in which nearly 300 people were killed, and Tiberius Gracchus was beaten to death with the fragments of a broken bench by 2 senators. Thereupon the senators attempted a sort of counter-revolution and proscribed many of the followers of Tiberius Gracchus. But the state of public opinion was so sullen and threatening that this movement was dropped, and Scipio Nasica, who was implicated in the death of Tiberius, though he occupied the position of Pontifex Maximus and should have remained in Rome for the public sacrifices which were the duties of that official, went abroad to avoid trouble. The uneasiness of Italy next roused Scipio Africanus the Younger to propose the enfranchisement of all Italy, but he died suddenly before he could carry the proposal into effect. Then followed the ambiguous career of Gaius Gracchus, the brother of Tiberius, who followed some tortuous policy that still exercises the mind of historians. He increased the burthens of taxation laid upon the provinces. It's opposed with the idea of setting the modern financiers, the equites, against the senatorial landowners. He gave the former the newly bequeathed taxes of Asia to farm, and what's worse, he gave them control of the special courts set up to prevent extortion. He started enormous public works, and particularly the construction of new roads, and he's accused of making a political use of the contracts. He revived the proposal to enfranchise Italy. He increased the distribution of subsidized cheap corn to the Roman citizens. Here we can't attempt to disentangle his schemes, much less to judge him, but that his policy was offensive to the groups that controlled the Senate, there can be no doubt whatever. He was massacred by the champions of law and order, with about 3,000 of his followers, in the streets of Rome in 121 BC. His decapitated head was carried to the Senate on the point of a pike.